a year out from an election, when you have an incumbent president, you're often going to see polls that show them, you know, running poorly. And then, of course, the pundit class is going to get obsessed with that. They're going to talk about nothing else. But we just had a remarkable intervention here, and that is an election, a relatively nationalized election, where you could ask the question, okay, given the choice, a clear choice on abortion rights, a clear choice on progressive issues versus going to the right, a clear choice on labor rights, a clear choice on a whole host of other issues, given that choice across the country in election after election after election, people voted for abortion rights, they voted for labor rights, they voted for progressive values. And for Democrats, who often don't get this right, this is a very, very powerful reminder that there's a route forward, but it isn't a route of concession. It's a route of activism and engagement with communities that are rising up and saying they want a different direction, a more progressive direction for this country.
And Amy, I'd like to get your sense of how the outcome of Tuesday's elections set the stage for 2024 and especially for the future of abortion rights. What's your sense?
I mean, Juan, I think crucially, as John pointed out, we saw the failure of the two signature Republican strategies that they were banking on for 2024. The first was this idea of a 15-week limit, of a compromise on abortion, right? And Glenn Youngkin was the face of this. He worked closely with Susan B. Anthony List. We've talked about this on the show before, how in the wake of the Dobbs decision, the anti-abortion movement tried to rebrand itself. Bans were not going to be bans anymore. They were going to be limits and compromises. And 15 weeks was supposed to be this, you know, compromise, as if voters were going to forget it was a 15-week ban in Mississippi that got us to the Dobbs decision in the first place, and that Mississippi is now living under a total abortion ban and has been for about a year and a half. So I think we can, you know, chalk the surprising success of the Democratic gubernatorial candidate there partly up to that reality. They haven't forgotten about Dobbs. But we saw this strategy of the 15-week compromise fall on its face in Virginia because voters saw right through that. They understood that an abortion ban is a ban. And this was a crucial part of their, you know, Republican strategy to rebrand themselves after the Dobbs decision. I think they're going to want to abort that strategy, Juan. I don't see that happening in the next 15 weeks. So unfortunately, I think they're going to have to carry it to term, or at least until the next election in 2024. The other signature Republican strategy we saw fall on its face, as John pointed out, was in Kentucky, where somewhere in the order of $6 million was spent by right-wing groups attacking Andy Beshear for vetoing a bill that would have banned gender-affirming care for minors. This anti-trans fear-mongering, again, did not work. Chef's kiss, no notes. I love that, $6 million might as well have been flushed down the toilet for all that it resonated with Kentucky voters in this deep red state, or what is known as a deep red state. And so I think Republicans are in serious trouble. And on the flip side of that, I want to say I don't think Democrats can just lay back and count on abortion rights to save their butts in 2024. We know that Joe Biden is tanking among Arab American voters right now. We know that he's struggling in swing states from the New York Times poll. This is a position that abortion rights supporters are not necessarily used to. We're used to abortion being a third rail in American politics and Democrats not taking the issue seriously. All of a sudden, it's looking like Democrats need the abortion rights movement more than the movement needs them. And it's not lost on me that while these results were coming in and it was becoming clear that abortion had lifted the boats of Democrats across all of the states, you know, from Virginia to Kentucky to Ohio and beyond, we saw 22 Democrats in Congress siding with Republicans to censure Rashida Tlaib, who, by the way, is one of the staunchest supporters of reproductive justice that we have in Congress, in addition to being the only Palestinian American. And so I think supporters of abortion rights really need to ask themselves, what are you going to do with this power that you now have? And are you going to compromise, or are you going to push the envelope and go big and push Democrats who now need this issue in order to win.
Amy Littlefield, Wynn, thank you for being with us. Abortion Access correspondent for The Nation. John Nichols, the nation's national affairs correspondent. A perfect segue into our next segment. We'll be playing the full speech of Rashida Tlaib, the only Palestinian-American member of Congress, just before she was censured by the U.S. House of Representatives. Back in 20 seconds.
The pictures left unpainted, all of the games they left unplayed, all the laughter in the playground, all of the arts they never made. Ghost faces of a million Palestinian children. All of those voices left in silence, all with their names written in kind. Lifeless empty dolls to find. Ghost faces of a million Palestinian children.
Palestinian Children by Peyote for President. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. On Tuesday, the House of Representatives voted to censure Democratic Congressmember Rashida Tlaib, the only Palestinian-American in Congress, for her criticism of Israel. The vote was 234 to 188, with 22 Democrats joining Republicans to censure Tlaib. Prior to the vote, the Congresswoman spoke from the House floor.
I'm the only Palestinian-American serving in Congress, Mr. Chair, and my perspective is needed here now more than ever. I will not be silenced, and I will not let you distort my words. Folks forget I'm from the city of Detroit, the most beautiful blackest city in the country, where I learned to speak truth to power even if my voice shakes. Trying to bully or censor me won't work, because this movement for a ceasefire is much bigger than one person. It's growing every single day. There are millions of people across our country who oppose Netanyahu's extremism and are done watching our government support collective punishment and the use of white phosphorus bombs that melt flesh to the bone. They are done watching our government, Mr. Chair, supporting cutting off food, water, electricity, and medical care to millions of people with nowhere to go. Like me, Mr. Chair, they don't believe the answer to war crimes is more war crimes. The refusal of Congress and the administration to acknowledge Palestinian lives is chipping away at my soul. Over 10,000 Palestinians have been killed. Majority were children. But let me be clear. My criticism has always been of the Israeli government and Netanyahu's actions. It is important to separate people and governments, Mr. Chair. No government is beyond criticism. The idea that criticizing the government of Israel is anti-Semitic sets a very dangerous precedent, and it's being used to silence diverse voices speaking up for human rights across our nation. Do you realize what it's like, Mr. Chair, for the people outside the chamber right now, listening in agony to their own government dehumanizing them? To hear the President of the United States, "We helped elect," dispute death tolls as we see video after video of dead children and parents under rubble. Mr. Chair, do you know what it's like to fear rising hate crimes, to know how Islamophobia and anti-Semitism makes us all less safe, and worry that your own child might suffer the horrors that six-year-old Wadia did in Illinois? I can't believe I have to say this, but Palestinian people are not disposable.
As Congressmember Rashida Tlaib composed herself, her sister Congresswoman Ilhan Omar put her hand on her shoulder, the only other Muslim woman in Congress.
"We are human beings, just like anyone else. My Sitti, my grandmother, like all Palestinians, just wants to live her life with freedom and human dignity we all deserve. Speaking up to save lives, Mr. Chair, no matter faith, no matter ethnicity, should not be controversial in this chamber. The cries of the Palestinian and Israeli children sound no different to me. What I don't understand is why the cries of Palestinians sound different to you all. We cannot lose our shared humanity, Mr. Chair. I hear the voices of advocates in Israel, in Palestine, across America, and around the world for peace. I am inspired by the courageous survivors in Israel who have lost loved ones, yet are calling for a ceasefire and the end to violence. I am grateful to the people in the streets for the peace movement, with countless Jewish Americans across the country standing up and lovingly saying, not in our name. We will continue to call for a ceasefire, Mr. Chair, for the immediate delivery of critical humanitarian aid to Gaza, for the release of all hostages and those arbitrarily detained, and for every American to come home. We will continue to work for a real lasting peace that upholds human rights and dignity of all people and centers in peaceful coexistence between Israelis and Palestinians and censures no one, and ensures that no person, no child has to suffer or live in fear of violence. 71% of Michigan Democrats support a ceasefire. So you can try to censure me, but you can't silence their voices. I urge my colleagues to join with the majority of Americans and support a ceasefire now to save as many lives as possible. President Biden must listen to and represent all of us, not just some of us. I urge the president to have the courage to call for a ceasefire and the end of killings. Thank you, and I yield.
That's Detroit Congressmember Rashida Tlaib, the only Palestinian American, speaking on the House floor before the House voted to censure her for her criticism of Israel. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we continue to cover Israel's bombardment of Gaza, we're joined by two guests, one Holocaust survivor, the other one of the world's leading genocide scholars. Omer Bartov is a professor of Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Brown University. He's the author of numerous books, including most recently Genocide, the Holocaust and Israel-Palestine, First-Person History in Times of Crisis. He's an Israeli-American scholar who's been described by the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum as one of the world's leading specialists on the subject of genocide. He recently signed an open letter warning of Israel committing a potential genocide in Gaza. We're also joined by Marion Ingram. She's an 87-year-old Holocaust survivor who's been protesting outside the White House calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. Longtime activist who was an organizer with SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, in the 1960s. She's the author of The Hands of War, A Tale of Endurance and Hope from a Survivor of the Holocaust, and Hands of Peace, A Holocaust Survivor's Fight for Civil Rights in the American South. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! We're going to begin with Marion Ingram. Before we talk about the ceasefire in Gaza, I'd like you to respond to the censuring of the only Palestinian-American member of Congress, Rashida Tlaib, whose speech we just played.
I totally support her comments. And I think it is, on top of that, shameful that her justified defense of human lives is considered anti-Semitic. It is pro-human beings. I find it horrific that the politicians have the nerve to censure righteous voices for peace and for the lives of Gazans who are being murdered. It is slaughter that is happening. And Rashida Tlaib is, in my eyes, a hero. Netanyahu's government, Israel's policies for decades has been the suppression of Palestinians, land grabs, deprivation of Palestinians. It is painful for me, as someone who has experienced all of the terrors that Gazans are experiencing, and even the horrific attacks in Israel by Hamas. But Hamas's attack on Israel does not justify the slaughter of women and children, especially children. I was a child of war. I have experienced all of these things. I've also known for a fact that what Israel is doing will not end this conflict. It will only exacerbate it. It will increase resistance to anything. I think that Biden needs to defund all of the money that is given to Israel. I think he should not only call for a ceasefire, I think he needs to start thinking about peace. We cannot continue to make wars and then call for ceasefires only to have wars start again after the ceasefire ends. We've experienced this over and over and over again. I am so tired of having to protest everything, wars, gun violence, the war against women. It is ridiculous that we are not able to think clearly. My husband has an expression, and that is all about the Benjis. I think that the happiest people in the universe must be the manufacturers of armaments. And probably are also complicit in the promotion. The fact that, the United States is complicit in this murder of children is to me a horrific indictment of inhumanity. And I applaud Rashida Tlaib with all of my heart, with all of my being. I think she's fantastic. I just wish that there were more voices to join her in the House.
Marian Ingram, I wanted to ask you, you grew up in Hamburg, Germany in the late 1930s and early 1940s. Could you tell us and to our audience some of your experiences that shaped and determined and made you want to participate in these protests in Washington against the Israeli bombardment and invasion of Gaza?
Because I am a Jew. My mother was a Jew. My family was murdered in 1941. My Jewish family was murdered in 1941. Hamburg Jews were sent to Minsk and Belarusia, upon arrival, they were stripped and then shot and dumped into a mass grave. My grandmother was taken to by two Gestapo who came to my mother's apartment and took her away the night before I turned 6 years old. From about the time I was 3 years old, I was aware that I was the object of hate of the German government, the German country. It was made clear by a playmate who told me that she wouldn't play with me because I was a dirty Jew pig. I had no idea what she was talking about. This horrific war against Jews and Germans who protested the Nazi regime progressed. It got worse. My mother had to go to the Gestapo every week. The only reason we were not taken in 1941 was because my mother had married a non-Jew. And this saved us in 1941. But in 1943, the Nazis said that all Jewish spouses were to be exterminated as well. And in 1943, in the summer of 1943, my mother got our deportation order to Theresienstadt. My mother tried to commit suicide in the hopes that my father's relatives would take in her children. in the hope that she would be able to save her three daughters. She had sent me off to one of the relatives who was instrumental in helping us, but I had not been allowed to be outside since the Nazis came to power, and it struck me as very odd. I was 7 and a half that she let me take my baby sister to my father's cousin. And I turned around, and I found my mother with her head in the gas oven. And I pulled her out. And my mother lived and never had another such moment, and was horrifically strong. Right after that, the Allies bombed the city of Hamburg. It was called Operation Gomorrah. The Brits bombed at night. The Americans bombed during the day. It was a 10-day and 10-night uninterrupted bombing. My mother and I were not allowed in a bomb shelter. We were forced to run through flaming streets. The Allies dropped phosphorus, and I saw human beings jumping into the lake and the canals and coming up. They were like human candles. Their bodies were in flame, and every time they jumped into the canals and lakes, the flames would be doused, but the minute they came up for air, they would be in flames. As a 7-and-a-half-year-old, I saw more dead bodies burned to a crisp. Two things. I'm a pacifist, and it's just ironic that this horrific revenge attack on civilians. It was entirely targeted on civilians. Saved my life because there were so many burned bodies that could not be identified that I was able to go into, we were able to go into hiding. This was arranged. My father was in the underground. He had managed to arrange for us to be hidden in a sort of ex-urban farm outside the city of Hamburg by communist underground members. The elderly couple who hid us were not pro-Semitic, but they were virulently anti-Nazi. And we were in hiding in a tar paper shack when there were no people, when there were no people around. When there were people around, we had to go hide in an earthen dugout. And on my 8th birthday, on 19th November 1943, in the earthen dugout, I told my mother that if I lived, I would never, ever be quiet, and that I wanted to become a peacemaker. Well, I've kept that promise. I have not been able to figure out how I can get governments to make peace. But I continue to battle on all fronts. I have battled when I came to America. As a 17-year-old, I saw that America was a racist country, and I became active in the civil rights movement. I
Marion,
in part two of our conversation, we're going to talk about your history in the civil rights movement. But just before we go to the Israeli-American genocide historian, Omer Bartov, just if you could share a message to the world about what never again means to you.
To me, it would mean never again to repeat the horrors that we have committed throughout my lifetime, and certainly before that. Nothing has been learned from the atrocities of the mid-20th century, the continued atrocities in Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan.
We've been holding signs of you calling for a ceasefire.
Yeah, I want more than that. I want peace. I'm disgusted at the fact that not a single nation, not a single leader has even mentioned that word, as though that is a word of a dangerous word. There has to be a way of bringing together warring parties. When the Allies attacked Hamburg, Germany, thinking that that would weaken the military conflict, it only strengthened it. What Israel is doing in Gaza, in the West Bank, and has been doing, is only going to strengthen the attack on Israel. You cannot expect that people will be quiet after what we've all witnessed. I say, stop this madness.
Yeah, I'd like to bring in Professor Omer Bartov, one of the most prominent scholars of Holocaust and genocide studies. Your sense, Professor Bartov, of what Israel is doing right now in Gaza?
Well, good morning, and thank you for having me. Look, what Israel is doing right now, according to its own political leaders and military commanders, is attempting to destroy Hamas, which is the hegemonic power in Gaza at the moment. And it claims to be doing it, as retaliation for the heinous attack on October 7th, where over 1,000 civilians were butchered and 240 people were kidnapped and are still kept in Gaza. But he claims to be doing it also because it feels that without doing that, it would be permanently under threat from that organization. So that's its own position. The problem with this position is not only is the massive and excessive and disproportionate killing of civilians, of Palestinian civilians in Gaza during this operation, but also that it doesn't have any clear political horizon. It is not clear what the day after would look like. And the reason the Israeli government does not want to talk about that is that it does not want to have any sort of compromise with the Palestinians. And that has been the policy of the Netanyahu administration, or many administrations, for decades now. And Netanyahu actually kept Hamas quite strong and kept the Palestinian leadership in the West Bank quite weak so that he could say that he could not find any representative of the Palestinians who would be willing to sit down and find a compromise, while at the same time he was busy, he and, of course, the settlers who are now heavily represented in his government could keep settling in the West Bank. So the larger context of this is that the refusal of the Israeli government to find any kind of compromise with the Palestinians, and frankly, the indifference of the large part, the majority of the Israeli population to the occupation, is what led and keeps leading to this ongoing and increasingly violent confrontation between Israel and the Palestinians.
Professor Omer Bartov, we're going to continue with part two of our conversation posted at democracynow.org. Brown University professor of Holocaust and Genocide Studies, called by the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum one of the world's leading specialists on the subject of genocide. And Marion Ingram, 87-year-old Holocaust survivor, about to turn 88. We thank you for sharing your experience. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Radio Rewind. The following content has previously aired on CJSF. But don't worry, we'll be back next week.